Hey, Pulp fans, thanks for your support. Whether you're subscribing to the podcast through iTunes, visiting pulpmx.com, streaming the show via the Stitcher app on your smartphone, or buying from our show sponsor, btosports.com, without you, we could not do this. You can still type M-A-T-T-H-E-S upon checkout at btosports.com if your order is $100 or more for a discount. Lastly, for some insider info and maybe a laugh or two, follow Mathis's Twitter updates at twitter.com/pulpmx. Water's clear and my ears underwater. Totter and hum from the car.
Disclaimer.
During this episode of the Steve Mathis Show, there is a high
chance ability
you will either learn something
a lot of people don't know,
you left thinking,
duh,
or make you say to yourself,
dude, that's so funny.
The bottom line is,
this podcast serves as archival
documentation
of this interview.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com Trans World Motocross podcast show. As usual, I'm your host, Steve Mathis. With me on the line is I know I say this all the time, but this truly is one of the guys that I've always wanted to get, one of the pioneers in the motocross industry, and that would be the founder of JT Racing, John Gregory. John, how are you?
Doing good, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, thanks for agreeing to do this. I know you don't do a whole lot of these things, and I want to thank Brock Glover before we get too far for hooking me up with you.
No problem. Glad to do it.
Yeah, great. We got a lot to talk about. But let's right off the top, let's talk about your AMA Motorcycle Hall of Fame induction, which just happened this past weekend in Las Vegas. Talk about that event for you.
Well, I think that the people we have to give most of the credit to right here are, for example, Brock was instrumental in the induction part for Rita and I. And I imagine that guys like Tom Heininger and Jack Benton, Eddie Cole, some other people played, you know, a role in it. I think that this is something that Brock pursued, I think, has been pursuing for some time, and he was the one that was, I think, that it kind of was dogged enough to finally get us inducted.
Was it an honor? Was it out of the blue? Were you kind of shocked when you heard about it?
Well, I wasn't really shocked. I think that what I like about it the most is the company that we were in. You know, Mitch was there, and it was unfortunate about Ivan, but there's a lot of good people that makes you feel good about being in that particular organization right there. But as far as going way back, it's no secret, I guess, that everybody in the industry has had their ups and downs with the AMA, and I think that even continues today.
Yeah, I think so. That's a good point.
That's
a good point.
To put it mildly.
That's a good point. I'm sitting here in my den doing this podcast, and staring directly out at me is a JT ALS 2 helmet with goggles, JT goggles on in the helmet, and a V2000 chest protector that my wife asks me, why do you have this stuff just in your den? And I don't know. I just do. So do you have any idea on sort of how iconic the company is that you started? I mean, do you look back now and go, wow, I guess I was part of something? Or, do you have any – I guess when you're in it, you have no idea the influence you're having, huh?
Well, I think we had an idea when we were in it. I think it's when you're out of it, you kind of you kind of lose touch. I'll give you some advice on the equipment that you've got in there. That sounds like some of the stuff that I had in my office that I never found a place for at my home. You're lucky at least you've got it in your house.
Yeah, yeah, no. I searched on eBay for a long time for a V2000. Obviously, I grew up wearing them, you know, but then, you know, you just lose touch of them, and I always wanted one, and found them on eBay, bid, you know, whatever, I think it was $140.
Whoa.
And, yeah, I got it, so I'm pumped.
I think that probably is the one product that you mentioned in an email earlier about one that was my favorite. I think that one was it. You know, we started out with the V2000. And then we evolved from there into four or five variations of it for, you know, four-wheelers and three-wheelers. And,
yeah.
And had a myriad of applications, actually.
So yeah.
It was a great product. A lot went into that product. A lot went into it.
Yeah, yeah. We'll touch on that in a little bit here. Now, obviously, one of the big news this past weekend, I was in Paris for the Bercy Supercross, and Sebastian Tortelli debuted the new reincarnation of JT, which I'm happy to say, you know, looks, they kept to the spirit of the original gear. You don't have anything to do with it, do you?
Nothing.
Did you know about it? Did they talk to you about it? Did they, anything?
Sort of input? About a year ago, they contacted me, and it sounded like work to me, so I never got involved.
Right, right. Did you see photos of it? Oh, I was in Vegas. Never mind. Yeah. So
no, that Vegas was the first time I'd seen anything. Mm-hmm.
And what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I hope it stands up to a good washing the first time.
I like how they used all of your logos. They used some 70s logos, 80s logos, you know, 90s logos. You know, they kind of used a whole bunch of the different JT logos over the years. I like how they stayed true to that. That was cool.
Yeah.
They didn't come. They didn't try to reinvent the wheel, you know.
Well, that would have been difficult. So.
Yeah, exactly.
They were smart there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, what are you up to now? Nowadays, you sold JT. Geez, I don't even. What year was it?
2001.
Okay, 2001. So, what's John Gregory doing these days?
Well, John Gregory today is trying to stay out of trouble, which is pretty easy to do where I live. I live in Idaho. When we had JT, when we sold JT, I've always we had our R&D in Sun Valley for Dolly for 20 years.
Okay.
And I love that country, and because of the involvement there, you know, Hannah had been up there a long time, and I've always wanted to get a place in the back country, and I found a ranch. And just off the Middle Fork of the Salmon up in the Frank Church Wilderness area. And I bought that about 7 years ago. And it's very remote. It's 60, I think the nearest town by road is 62 miles away.
Jeez.
And the only practical way in is flying.
Yeah. So,
and I've been a pilot since 1980, so
wow.
I fly it. A little plane called a Super Cub, and that's my way in and out every day.
Jeez. Wow, yeah, you are out there in the woods. What about starting JT? You know, there's the myth about JT is Tijuana, TJ backwards. You started with motocross socks. Is that correct? Is that what I've heard over
the
years?
Yeah, that's what started the whole thing. One of the people that I've worked with, and I've worked to this day, his name is David Stevenson, and excuse me, as you may or may not know, I think you do, I had a degree in pharmacy. I graduated from little school in Oklahoma and immediately headed west to California and started my career in pharmacy there in 1964. And anyway, I came out here and worked for 2 or 3 years, and then about, oh, Lord, yes, probably 65 or 6, I met a guy in Corona. I was working in Corona, California, and I met the local Honda dealer. His name was Floyd Burke, and Before that, I had bought a couple of Trail 90s. I didn't know much about dirt bikes or anything. I just liked to be outside and explore, and those little bikes were an excellent way to do it. Anyway, I hooked up with Floyd, and the next thing I know, he's dragging me to the desert.
Uh-huh.
And he's the one, I guess, that I have to give all the responsibility for getting me started on this whole thing.
Dirt bikes, yeah.
Yeah, dirt bikes. And then after that, I started racing District 37 because that's where we were.
Mm-hmm.
In 68 or so, I moved to San Diego in that area. And about the same time, I met Dave, and we had this little one-man pharmacy that Rita and I owned and ran. And Dave said, he said, God, you better do something. This racing is running you into the ground. So it was because of Dave's suggestion, and he kind of inspired us to launch into JT. And I had, we'd all been wearing these old gray and red surplus. But you bought them in surplus stores.
Yep.
Those big old wool socks. They were the only thing that would go over the top of a lineman boot, and that's back in the days when everybody wore their socks on the outside.
Right.
And we happened to go to a race one time. It was at Dehesa, a track called Dehesa in the San Diego area. There was a kid, his name was Robbie Norgard. I'll never forget him, and he was wearing them, and I asked him where he got them, and he gave me the name of a sporting goods store in Tijuana, and the next thing you knew, we had a dozen pair. And by then, I had met some of the guys from Husky. Dick Lachine was the dealer that I had done all of my, I hung out at his shop when I hung out. And so I met Niels Arney and, I can't even think of them. So many, of course, Lars was around with Torsten Hallman.
Right.
But most of it was based around Husqvarna. And then we started out buying them just from the local sporting goods thing, and then I found out through a friend of mine in Arizona, he was at the banquet, to a fellow named Danny Martinez, and Danny was my official translator, and Danny helped me track the manufacturer down, and then...
In Mexico.
Yeah, I was down in a little town called Puebla, and... God, we sold the crap out of them. thanks to Torsten Hallman Racing,
yeah.
Lars Larson and Brigitte
yep.
Berlin were the principals that basically ran the business. And then we had started. We got started basically through mail order, and that's how we made our first impact. And through Lars and ultimately through guys like Kent Erlien, Torleif Hansen, the Swedish mafia guys.
Yeah, that were doing the Trans Ams and stuff.
Wolfsink and all of this. We were lucky enough to hook up with Joel, and he was our first rider.
Were they thinner? Like, they weren't as cool, as hot as the wool socks, or were they different colors, or what was it that was so cool about them? Just they fit better?
Well, they were cotton, number one.
Those, all right.
Those things we had to buy were wool, and God, you'd buy those things, and they'd itch like crazy. And you go through a pair of race, and they look crappy.
Cotton and colors and thinner. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and these are also the same model that if you wash with a white jersey, you ended up with a pink outfit right away. So, kind of careful.
Yeah, and that was it. Then you were off, huh?
That was it.
And JT, TJ, everybody, like I lived in San Diego, everybody calls it TJ, Tijuana, and you just said, hey, let's reverse that. That was it?
Yeah, it was Rita. I have to give her all the credit for that. We
yep.
had to get a business license, and I think everybody's heard that story. And
yeah.
We either had a choice of going to the back of the line or coming back the next day. And
yeah.
And so I thought of just calling it TJ Racing, and Rita, in her infinite wisdom, said, that doesn't sound too good, so the rest is history.
Then that was it, and you were off from there. Yeah. And then expanding the line, you all of a sudden you realize there's a market, you're successful, and all of a sudden jerseys and pants and all that came along, huh?
Well, I think that most of it was, it's kind of like a surviving a crash. You know, there was never really any plans.
Mm-hmm.
Things just started to happen. You know, I mentioned
Right. Kent
and all those other guys, and the next thing you know, they kind of took us under the wing, and they introduced us to this guy and that guy, one of them being Bob Twin with Twin Air. We were the original importer for him for a while. And then, you know, Garrett was there, and he inspired. We tried handlebars for a while. Actually, we did really good. I can't even remember who made them now, but
yeah,
you know, it was just sort of a, my God, it was almost like a Chinese fire drill, but it worked. You know, there was so much. The sport was young, and God, didn't seem like you could do anything wrong, and so we were lucky enough to be right there, the right place at the right time.
Right, and as far as getting the pro riders, was it just a matter of getting Joel and the Swedes on your side, and they probably were pumped just to get free stuff, and it worked good, obviously, because JT's always been known as the company that had, you know, all the riders, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, I think that, again, I'd never had any formal, even in college, you know, I haven't had one course in business or anything. I just knew how to really, you know, my strict sense was probably innate, and I knew how to type and how to make change for a 20 as far as my business experience.
Right.
But it doesn't take much to, you know, you just stand around, just watch what other people are doing, and it was obvious that if you wanted to get your name out, one of the quickest ways was to hook up with the riders, and that's exactly what we did.
And then at what point did you close down the pharmacy, and you were like, hey, wait a minute, this is like a real deal?
No, I think I hooked up with Rolf Tiblin a little bit, and my first trip to Europe was to go over and take care of some business with the Twin Air thing. And through that, I met a guy, his name was Joha Tirinen, through Rolf. Rolf knew him, Rolf Tiblin. And so when I was at Amsterdam, I hooked up with Joha, which, by the way, he just left here. He spent the week with me. And Joha was the founder. He was the first guy. I give him the credit for basically inventing nylon and leather. He worked with a company called Coho.
Okay, yeah, which made hockey equipment.
That's it.
Right.
And then subsequently, he ended up with a company called Yoko, which everybody has heard of.
Coho, me being Canadian, so I'm well aware of Coho and you know, sort of where they came from. Let's talk about the V2000 now. Did Hanna's HRP come out before the V2000?
It may have been...
I was wondering if that's an inspiration of some sort.
I think it came to market a little bit before, but the V2000 was a much more complicated project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hanna's stuff, a gentleman by the name of Chris Dawson, who ended up working for me, was the guy that spearheaded that project.
Okay.
And I had a guy here in Idaho, in Sun Valley, by the name of John Dondero. And also a guy that nobody's ever heard of before, his name was Jerry Parks. Jerry was instrumental in our R&D. He was my first employee, and he was working for us when we sold the company in 2001.
Oh, wow.
So that wasn't the way we did it. It wasn't just kind of like falling off of a log. It was a lot of work went into that.
Right, right. And what were some of the problems you had with it, or what were the early incarnations of that thing? Do you remember sort of what worked and what didn't?
Well, we went through several, not as many as you would think, but some prototypes. And, of course, we worked with a few riders on developing a comfort level for it, and also to make sure that, you know, the protective aspects were there, too. But it was a long, laborious project, though.
Yeah, and when you released it, what was the response? Like, I'm 36 years old, so, you know, I don't really remember. I remember, you know, wanting one as a kid, but when you released it, was it instantly popular? Was it, did it take off right away?
No, I think that we, one of the things that the professional guys, I can't even think of one right now that wore the whole thing. A lot of them wore the V1000,
right,
you know, the chest protector version of it. And so we had good luck there getting riders to wear it, but not too many of them wore the full coverage model. We had a version we made for three-wheelers that we had some guys wear it a little bit. But
with the belly open.
Exactly.
I think I've seen Bailey, some photos of Bailey on the Honda wearing like an 83 or 82 wearing a full V2000. But you're right, not a lot of guys did.
Yeah.
And then I guess, so that, there wasn't a huge seller right away. Because all I know is I'm coming from experience of growing up, they were everywhere. Look at the local races, you know?
Well, I think the average rider pretty well accepted it.
Right.
You know, as far as the comfort level wearing the thing, I wore it all the time. I raced desert back then. And so I think that was one thing that, you know, parents were pushing their kids to do whatever they could to avoid any kind of an injury, and I think a lot of parents are responsible for getting that on a lot of people. And then I've always felt if you had an ounce of brains at all, you'd be silly not to wear either that or some kind of chest and back protection.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, looking through some old magazines I have, good God, just every... every name was wearing JT. At one point, you had to have, you know, out of the top 20, you probably had 17 or 18 of the top 20 guys. Were they seeking you out, or were you just, at the time, compared to the companies that were around, were you more aggressive? Were you paying more, or were they riders just coming to you because of the quality of the and the looks of the stuff? How did you manage to get so many guys?
Well, I think that we were right back then. Like I said earlier, we were kind of the first ones, you know, to do it and try to get on board with it. Some came to us for sure, and then of course we approached a fair number of them too. Mm-hmm. We tried to get the best guys on it, and we started out with the very first one was, although the V2000 came after Joel, but starting with him. It was just a matter of going to races and introducing yourself and, you know, kind of hitting it off with different people and working out different things with different people.
Right.
It wasn't until, I guess, kind of in Hannah's, in his little, you know, when he first started, that we started to kind of formalize, you know, with contracts and and actively seeking riders and paying bonuses, and it got fairly sophisticated.
Yeah,
you know, in the late 70s. Mm-hmm.
Did it ever get to a point where you were wondering, you know, sort of, you know, how much were you going to pay these guys? Was business just booming so good that it was no problem to just keep adding guys? Or was business just blowing up at this point? Early '80s.
Yeah, it was doing really well.
Yeah,
but about then everybody, you know, kind of started catching on to what we were doing, too.
Right. Fox, you know, came around in the early 80s, huh?
Well, Fox has kind of always been there. But then some of the, like Cinesalo came over here. They established their own offices here, like up in Irvine. And they were paying guys a lot of money. And you know, we had a pretty, you know, pretty good deal for a while until our competition moved in, you know. Mm-hmm. Answer and O'Neill and Fox and goes and Cinesalo and others, and we just no longer could afford to have all of them like we, you know, we had at one time.
Yeah. Ward left for Cinesalo. RJ left for Cinesalo, although he would come back years later. O'Mara for Answer. But again, you still had, you know, most of the top riders.
I think that one of the good things about that, we had some really loyal guys too, and that was a huge factor. And I think that's one of the reasons that Rita and I were inducted into the AMA was because of that loyalty. And thanks to Hannah and Brock and some of the guys that knew us along the years. But we always prided ourselves, or I always did, on the relationships that we had with our riders.
Right.
And then as the years went on, it became, more and more difficult to hang on to guys because, my God, they were being paid. You could only afford one or two really good ones.
Yeah. What's the most you paid for a rider? What was the most biggest contract you gave out? Was it RJ, like 89?
No.
No?
I think the biggest cash thing we ever did, we worked out, was with Badle.
Oh, yeah?
When he came over. But our deal there included a goggle also.
Mm-hmm.
So he was out. He was JT that 1 year, head to toe. He had everything.
Right.
And then probably after that, I don't know, Ricky was up there.
Yeah.
Bob was probably our first really high-ticket rider.
Yeah. I heard a story. I don't know if it's true. You can confirm this. A friend of mine worked for JT in the early 90s out east as a rep. And he said that one of the reasons that you sort of sold the company, it started becoming disillusioned with it a little bit, was right around the early 90s. You had some riders signed up under contracts, and they weren't showing up for photo shoots, or they would show up a day late, or, you would put a lot of effort into doing a catalog shoot, and these guys would kind of blow it off or something. And you just got to be really disillusioned by it. Is that true?
I don't know who you're talking to. I'd like to know the guy's name. He didn't know what the fuck he was. Excuse me. He didn't know what he was talking about.
You could swear on this. That's all right.
He didn't have a clue.
Okay. So the story. That's not true. You didn't have problems like that.
No.
Contracts,
as a matter of fact, it was just the opposite.
Oh yeah. Okay.
We'd have guys come up and we always made a day out of it, and we always had fun. But they always looked forward to it.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want to say anything about people that were showed up. Well, we had Ronnie sometimes would show up late, but he always showed
imagine,
up.
Imagine that.
And then we had, Brock was next door, and my God, I've seen some of the old files on Brock. We must have taken 3 million pictures of that guy.
Yeah, Brock says he still has some prototype stuff, and he was heavily involved, obviously, working with you.
But every single rider, I can't think of anybody that we ever had a hard time with a photo session.
Okay.
That's totally untrue. That if there's one thing we had a great deal of success with, it was at a photo shoot,
right,
I guarantee
right.
you.
Yeah, it's a moto myth. It's a moto legend myth.
Moto myth.
Yeah. Hey, what's the coolest thing you're proud of for all the products that you've come out with? What either sold the most, or what are you the most proud of? Is it the V2000, or is there something else that, the helmet maybe? Is there one idea that stands above the rest?
Well, there were a couple. The V2000 I mentioned before was kind of our pride and joy, and we put so much work into it. The helmet was incredible.
Yeah.
I think we were way before our time on that particular product.
And I would agree, yeah.
And we worked with two or three manufacturers during the course of the history of that thing. And I still wear a JT helmet.
Do you really?
And I have some of the extra fit kits that I saved through the years, and I still wear them at the ranch.
Oh, wow.
Three or four that are practically brand new.
It's
as good as it got. The only thing we didn't have, and it hurt us a lot, was not being Snell approved in those days.
Yeah, I can vouch
today,
for that.
Today, everybody's DOT and Snell. I don't know. They've changed the standards so much, it's hard to keep track with exactly how they did that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can vouch for that because I'm a Canadian, and we couldn't wear them up there because it had to be Snell approved, and it was, it was a big crushing blow for sure. Because they were the coolest things out there. So the helmet and the chest protector, a couple ideas that you're super proud of?
Yeah, I think those are the main ones for sure. And we had almost everything we did. I thought we kind of tried to make a little bit better mousetrap. And we had some others that were very successful. you know, the mouth trap that we have, the mouth guard, the old Jofa kind of a model, and the old original face fender thing. You know, we sold, good God, we sold so many of those, I couldn't even count them.
Wait, you're talking about the Jofa thing, or what else was
it? No, it was, remember, I don't know if you remember or not, but the one before full-face helmets were out, people were just putting a, I think, Knobby Shop International came out with the very first one.
Yeah, like a Scott mask, too. Scott came up.
No, it was the thing that bolted to the lower part of the helmet.
Oh, okay, yeah, right. No, I got you, yeah.
People, I don't know what they even call them, face
Yeah,
fingers.
Mouth guards or something, yeah. Yeah, so you sold a ton of those?
Bunch of them.
Right.
Bunches of those.
But
the helmet was never successful.
It wasn't?
Because of... Really? Of we didn't have, you know, they weren't Snell approved. Mm-hmm. The AMA didn't require Snell approval in for liability reasons, but we were able, as long as it was DOT approved, then it was okay with them.
Right. Yeah, no, the helmet's still, like I said, I'm looking at it right now. It's still, I was a mechanic for Factory Yamaha, and a guy traded me his JT-ALS2 for a complete set of plastic off Tim Ferry's motorcycle, and I feel like I just ripped him off so bad.
Well, maybe you did.
I did. I couldn't get that plastic fast enough off the bike, but they didn't sell that good, huh?
No, and the reason being what we just talked about. For some reason, people had been browbeat and been beat into their heads so many years about Snell being the only standard that was safe. When in fact, for off-road, DOT was a much better standard. Again, I don't know what finally brought the two together, but I know at the time that it was impossible to have a DOT-approved helmet that would meet the Snell standard.
Right, and even just the shape of the shell is unique. You still don't see that kind of shape, and you know, just a groundbreaking thing. And I always thought the goggles were pretty good too. I wore the goggles for many years, and they were a quality goggle compared to a Scott or an Oakley, you know, which was the top of the line back then.
So. Well, I think that the goggle was one of the reasons how we kind of got started in the whole thing. Scott was in financial trouble in the early 80s, and we were fortunate enough to be able to hire a couple of their people in Sun Valley. And that, again, that goes back to my roots.
Yeah.
They wouldn't leave Sun Valley, so that's why I started the R&D thing up there. But our goggle was a good goggle and still is. I still, of course, here I go. I still have quite a few around, but I'd still wear it today.
Right. Yeah, no, I wore it for many years. I just thought it was really good. So we covered some of the best ideas. What are some of the worst ideas, or what are some of the things that didn't work that you thought would be awesome or you know, vice versa, that just didn't work, period? Were there any products that stood out? I got one for you.
Okay, let's have yours.
What about the Flex-On glove?
well, we sold a bunch of them.
Yeah.
I knew we were in trouble. We gave one to David Bailey, and God, it came back, and he completely modified his. But that was just one of those things you tried. You won't believe it. We sold a ton of them.
Right. Okay. Is there something else? That's just my own idea. But
well, you know, everybody, we had so many complaints about the V2000 not being comfortable enough. We came out with a different full coverage shoulder pad a little bit later, and it was a total bomb. You know, that was kind of when
it had a hinge on it, didn't it? Didn't have a hinge. Oh.
I don't know what it had on it, but whatever it had on it, it didn't work.
It wasn't good.
Didn't have much of feel.
Right. So that was probably one of the things.
Yeah, that was probably the costliest mistake we ever made.
Yeah. And it's got to be weird because, like you said, like some things hit and you don't really know why, and some things miss and you guess the same thing, you don't really know why, right?
Yeah. Right. I think nearly every one of our products, it was all part of that, you know, that time when we just couldn't do anything wrong.
Right.
And then we kind of reached a point in the company when it was possible to do something wrong.
biggest seller in JT's history, the mouth guard, the V2000, biggest thing you sold. Most profitable, biggest thing, however you want to measure it.
Well, I think that our line of gloves obviously had to be, we probably sold more gloves than we did any other single product.
Yeah.
But there were several involved and several different models, but we sold a lot of the mouth guards, a lot of the plastic stuff, and it was a high margin, sometimes high ticket item that was very, very lucrative for us.
Right. Oh, interesting. And then as far as riders, do you have a favorite? Do you have one guy you worked with that just was awesome? Maybe Brock?
You know, I think when you go back, it's kind of like if you have 10 kids, you know, which one do you kill first? And
right.
you really can't pick one. We we had so many different experiences with all of them. You know, I think what I alluded to earlier along the lines of being loyal, that the ones that I have my fondest memories of are the guys that were the most loyal to us. But I mean, my God, you can go down the whole list, you know, Brock and Laporte and Hannah and you know, Wolfink. I mean, they were all. I always prided myself in, I guess it just kind of boiled down to I just didn't work with an asshole, and that's all there was to it.
Saying
that all the rest of them were.
But
the guys that we worked with, we got along with so well, and obviously some worked with us a lot longer than others. You know, David, my God. The work that he did, and not very many people know, but David's responsible. He did a lot, you know, to help us with in the latter years in logo design. The new logo that JT currently uses, that was David's idea.
Oh, really?
David's a talent.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Now it's time to pay some bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped to anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at BTOsports.com.
Big talent.
Yeah.
But to pick one,
yeah.
I just, you know, I can tell stories about every one of them, but I just wouldn't pick one.
Yeah. Well, you should tell us some Lachine stories for sure.
Yeah, well, there's too many of those to tell.
not so many.
I, you know, we'd known, like I said, when I first started racing.
I didn't even know Dick was a Husky dealer.
Yeah, he was Honda and Husky. He had a Honda Lemon Grove in Lemon Grove, California.
Like way before oil, right? Like he wasn't into oil then? Or was he?
I wasn't into anything when I started working with Dick. And so I knew Ronnie when he was a little bitty kid.
Right, you know, right.
God, we watched him born, practically. In fact, he's I think 2 years old, something like that, first time I saw him.
Oh, yeah, no, he's a good friend of mine now. I do quite a bit with him, and He's a talent and a character for sure.
Yeah, they're all of them are
right.
Special. Every one of them are special.
Talk about the idea behind the Bad Bones gear. How'd that come about?
Well, again, I think Ronnie probably, you know, that was during his time, and we had a fellow working for us, Chris Dawson, who right now I think he's. One of the he's working with Malcolm Smith designing his stuff, and Chris kind of got that whole thing going.
Uh-huh.
But it was kind of, you know, when Ricky was with Life's a Beach and you know, that growling looking logo that they had.
Right.
So it didn't really fit one particular person. It was just kind of a bad boy kind
image,
of
image. Right.
Yeah, we stuck it on a couple of people. Or it fit best on Ronnie at the time.
and then also the Dalmatians, which was Ronnie's favorite gear.
That whole thing came about because of his name, and I thought it'd be fun to do. I think outside of the stuff that Bob wore, you know, in the late 70s, that's probably one of the most successful.
Oh, really?
Signature lines that we had. Yeah,
yeah.
We had We had boots and everything.
Yeah, no, it was crazy. And actually, you made him some one-off stuff that had Dalmatians on the back also.
Right.
That he wore, which, I mean, I had the Dalmatians, but it was standard stuff, obviously. But
and by then, David was painting helmets, and David also painted some helmets for Ronnie, too.
Yeah.
It was, I think it's, even today, it looks maybe a little weird, but I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I...
And that was the first photo shoot. I'm not going to say that Ronnie was never on time, but
right,
boy,
right,
he was on time for that one, because he knew we were going to have about 7 Dalmatian puppies, and I think he was actually early for that one and stayed all day.
Yeah, I can picture the ad now with his mullet and the seven dogs all over him, and he had his 88 Destinations helmet in the bottom of the photo. Actually,
yeah, you can tell just by the expression on his face.
Yeah.
He was having fun.
Yeah,
which goes back again to what you said earlier about these guys not liking photo shoots.
Right, right. Yeah,
Every one of them loved that.
All right, we can squish that.
Yeah.
What was it like working with JMB? How was that? I mean, he won you some championships and some titles. What was it like? What do you remember about JMB?
He's one of the nicest kids we ever worked with.
Yeah,
I loved
yep.
him. You know, he even came to Idaho a couple of times. He just showed up at the door. He got that little old pickup of his and came up here. We went.
Yep.
He liked to fish. We played once or twice, we would one-on-one paintball, and I loved the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, fortunately, you know, back in those days, French guys didn't sell anything.
Uh-huh.
And although he was our main rider back then, you know, it was after all of these other products had come out, and we didn't really have anything that we could use a rider of his caliber to promote. And
right.
He was kind of trying to maintain our position, and nobody liked him. My God, we'd go to races and they'd boo him. I remember, and I think it was in Oklahoma City. I wasn't there, but Rita was, and she said when he won one championship, the crowd just booed him like he was a terrorist or something.
Well, that's I have this question written down: was how tough was that? Because yeah, I mean, motocross action at the time didn't do him any favors, and you know, he was a little quiet and shy, and you know, I just did one of these shows with Dave Arnold, who loves JMB, but said he was stubborn and kind of had his own way about him. So yeah, one of the questions I had was, it didn't help you in sales, did it, winning those
No.
three titles in 1 year and all that? Yeah,
no, not a bit. I don't think we obviously they got a lot of exposure from
right.
sure, but it didn't, maybe it was a combination of that and just not having, you know, that magic product, that magic bullet to kind of
right.
throw around. God knows motocross action never tried to help us very much, so.
Yeah. What's the relationship like with Jody and all that? Was it tough?
It was non-existent.
Really? That's a lot of money you're pouring into for ads.
Yeah, I know, but you know, it was one of those things. But in the later years, you know, we pulled most of that out. We went with Davey and, you know, guys like that.
Right,
so.
Right. And then also too, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Well, Fox comes out with zebra stripe pants and polka dots, and you know, the market was changing a little bit. People were taking some of your ideas and running with it, and I guess that's what competition is, right?
Yeah, guess so. But whoever said that's the sincerest form of flattery, I'd like to have a talk with him. Obviously, he was Chinese or something. I don't
right,
know
right,
I don't
right.
know what he was.
He
wouldn't like me.
Yeah, he wouldn't be a big fan of you, huh? And then also, how did you start getting into the Tai Chi stuff? How did that come about with, because it was sort of JT-ish, right? You distributed?
Yeah. Well, you know, Tai Chi was a big importer of ours.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, you know, they were on the gas and doing, that was during those times when the Japanese were just, couldn't stop them doing anything, real estate
uh-huh.
or motocross, it didn't matter. And so we helped them develop their own line.
Okay, all right. So financially, you still had a stake in it a little bit?
No more than just a supplier and manufacturer. For
them. Yeah, I always wondered, because like, you know, JMB left after 91 and kind of yet still wore Tai Chi.
Yeah.
I don't know, it was a weird deal.
Well, it's one of those things when the Japanese are paying ungodly amounts of money for riders. You must have heard some of them, what they were paying. I don't know if they ever got paid or not. I heard some did and some didn't, but they, you know, they sucked Danny out and Bale, and they were working with, I think, Kevin Swans at the time. They were paying him like millions of dollars, something like that.
Yeah, Matasevich, Larry Ward all wore it too.
Yeah, yeah, they were. They picked up quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, I always wondered that story. And then, how did you get into paintball? Was it just a hobby, like just a passion of yours?
Well, you know, about that time, it was so hard in motocross. Margins were down. Everybody had started going to Taiwan and started with China yet. But, God, it just got so tough to make a margin. And one day, Marty Tripes, you know, Marty at the time, we had a retail store.
Mm-hmm.
Nearby that Marty had helped us with before, and Marty was always project oriented. And I remember one night, not very many people know this, but Marty was quite a seamstress.
We
had a sew shop there, and I heard a machine rattling one night about 7 o'clock. And I said, God, I thought I was the only one here, and I went in and found Tripes hunched over a sewing machine sewing up something. I said, what are you doing? And he said, he was making a hood for paintball. And he said, you ought to come and play with me. And I did, and I never had so much fun in my life.
It was
almost as much fun as riding a bike.
Huh.
And so because of that one little trip that I took with Marty, that kind of got me inspired. We started to look into it and found out that these guys were running around with absolutely no protection for their eyes at all.
Yeah.
Other than sunglasses and shop goggles and ski goggles and motocross goggles. And at that time, there was absolutely no rule, it didn't seem to be as well as I remember, governing the speed of the paintball. Now it's very closely regulated.
Right.
Back then, it wasn't. I mean, my God, you could go through a quarter-inch piece of plywood with one of those things.
Really, huh? Yeah, they were bad.
and eye injuries were quite common. And we modified one of our goggles. And from the day we entered the market with that goggle, we were back-ordered even the day that I signed the final papers when we sold it.
Really, huh? Just that just took off, just like Moto in the 80s, in early 80s.
Unbelievable, even more than that.
Yeah, and you were selling, was the paintball mask just the JT goggle middle and face protector, or was it a special paintball thing?
Well, the only difference between the motocross model and the paintball model was the thickness of the lens.
Okay.
And motocross lenses use a 30,000 Lexan sheet. It's fairly flexible, and we'd come up with a 100,000 thick lens. You could shoot it with a shotgun and not right. break it.
Wow!
So it was a fairly easy thing to get into, and of course, everything that we'd learned in moto, we applied to paintball.
Right.
I mean, right down to putting numbers on the backs of players and their names and all that stuff.
Right. And you had little helmets you came out with,
Well, the pros didn't wear helmets, but later on, today they have helmets, but back then they didn't.
Yeah, and I guess with the sales, you were just like, hey, wait a minute, this is too much to ignore here. I got to look into this.
It was way too much, and I should have gotten out of motocross before I did, and then it would have been fun because we were paintball was paying the bills, and we were trying to keep motocross afloat, so there was a period there where paintball was totally dependent on,
motocross was
totally dependent on paintball just to, you know, keep the doors open.
And would this have been, like, what years would this have been? 95, 94, like somewhere around there? Or earlier than that even?
Yeah, right. Yeah, 90, in the early, say, the first half of say, 90 to 95, paintball started for us in about 86, 87.
Oh, was that early? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Paintball started in the early 80s. In fact, it may have even started before that, but
yeah.
It started to become really popular in the 80s and then continued on. It was really ramping up in the early 90s. And that's
around the Bale years and all that was when it was really
starting
to take off.
That's when we started to make the transition.
Right. I still say JT made the nicest over-the-boots gear out there, by the way. I thought that was pretty sweet. Tim Ferry wore it in Washougal 96. What would you do different if you had to do it all over again? Anything? Any regrets?
You mean just in motocross?
Yeah, in motocross. Just all the stuff you've done.
God, I don't know. You know, I think one of the reasons that you want to talk about things that kind of bummed me out that were lawsuits. Toward the end of the motocross part of it, all I did was give depositions and go to them and
really, huh?
And look up crap for lawyers, and it was unbelievable. The lawsuits we were involved in.
Like people breaking an arm and suing the you for the V2000 or whatever, that kind of stuff.
There was one guy I remember in Florida. He got hit on a Yamaha. He got some little kid center punched him with a four wheeler, and my God, you know, he just went down the whole list. He was wearing our knee and shin, so we got drug into it because of that, and Yamaha was pulled into it, and Bell, I mean, every company he had on there. I think he'd been through it two or three times before.
But
it was really frustrating.
You know, right. Cool. And meanwhile, the paintball guys are they're happy.
Well, they're happy, but they know how to sue, too.
Okay,
didn't, but it was much more lucrative than paintball, so it didn't hurt quite so much.
Yeah. No, for sure. So nothing you'd really do different, huh? Like, pull out earlier, I guess? Pull out a motocross earlier?
Well, no. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. No, not especially that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's I think that it's all part of we were one of the first ones to do that, I think a lot of the things we did, we did as well as we could have done it, and wouldn't do any good to try to relive it. I don't know of anything that we could have done that would have improved the charisma of the company. Actually, I think we did a lot of things right. There's a lot of little things, but nothing major like. Just would have blown it one way or the other.
Yeah. Actually, one question I did have, the pink gear that Brock wore and Jackie Vimon wore, and actually Vimon was out at Bercy this weekend with it on. And oh, by the way, I told Xavier that you said hi to, by the way.
Good. All right.
The pink gear, your idea? I know Brock said at the time he did not want to wear, but was that your idea?
Well, yeah, it was our idea. You know, it was back in those days, we were just like today when they want to do something new, they come up with these squirrely-looking patterns that, my God, they look like they've been tattooed from head to foot. All we had back in those days, since the printing process was fairly limited, we just used different colors. And I just thought the pink would just kind of shock people. And so we made that outfit up for Brock, and he absolutely refused to wear. You heard the whole story. Because the Japanese were there, and he thought they'd think, kind of anyway. But when he put it on, he had to ride fast, so it worked out.
Did you sell much of it? I know it was for sale in magazines, but yeah. No.
Not a lot.
No.
And it wasn't one of those extremely. But Brock he didn't like to wear it, In retrospect, I don't really blame him, but Jackie really liked it, and we sold quite a bit of it in France.
Sure. Jackie's almost sort of known for it, He wore helmet and everything. Yeah,
he loved it.
The French.
Yeah.
The pink gear was certainly pretty shocking, and one of the stories that I heard, I think Lachine told me this, was you guys had the ability to . It was really cool back in the day because you could take, with your sewing shop, you could just take any panels and sew them on anywhere you wanted, and you would have a custom pair of pants in like an hour. Is that true? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
He said it was always cool to be down there because somebody would be like, hey, why don't we take this back panel and this front panel and this spandex and we'll make it, which nowadays never really happens. So.
Well, I think that's one of the neat things. Again, it goes back to, it wasn't just photo shoots those guys would come down for, but we had you know, David would come down and Bailey would come down and spend all day with us, and he loved to just mess with things.
Yeah.
We'd try this and try that and lycra here and invented stuff there, and we were always doing something different.
The Flow Orange certainly was one of the more standout looks from JT over the years.
Yeah, yeah. That one did pretty well, though.
Did it? Yeah.
That one did good. Yeah.
And also, too, your boots. How were the boots for you? Did they sell good? Were they?
You know, that we did okay with the boots, but there weren't huge numbers. Again, you know, everybody, we always tried to work with a good company. We worked with Alpine Stars and Guy Ernie and Axo and one or two others earlier and one or two later. Mm-hmm. But it was always something that kind of, completed the line. The boot guys were always really on top of it, and they kind of kept the best stuff, and you can't blame them for that for sure for themselves. Yeah.
I heard a story a while ago that, you know, you were one of the first companies to put the OEM names on the side of their pants, like Honda, Japan, Yamaha, and all that. I always think they should still do that, but they stopped you from doing that? Is that a true story? Because it was their name? They own it?
Yeah, they really didn't stop us.
Oh, okay.
We just quit doing it because we were, you know, we were paying these guys all the money and didn't see after a while that, you know, they started coming in and asking for 5 or 10% royalty. Well, that was BS. So we just left them off.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah.
But for sure, if we hadn't have had that pressure from the factories, we would have continued on. And once we got pressure from, you know, one or two of them, then we couldn't really complete the line.
Yeah, yeah.
And by then, I was so sick of dealing with attorneys, I just saw it as one more way to avoid, you know, spending time in court and paying a lawyer.
Yeah. I always thought they should go back to that, but I guess there you go. Now I know why, you know?
Well, I think the big reason, if, you know, 5 or 10% on a product today makes a big difference in whether you can be competitive with it or not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, for sure. Is there a secret bunker somewhere where you have all of this JT stuff still brand new, still in packages? Is there
you know,
Area 51 of JT Racing?
You know, I can kick myself. I can remember we had a tax issue with the state of California one time. They came in and audited our books, and one of the first things they saw was all the stuff that we gave to our riders, and they wanted to know, well, did those guys pay sales tax on it?
Yeah.
And I said, well, God, no, I didn't pay sales tax on it. Well, guess who paid the sales tax on all that stuff that we gave away?
That would be you.
So for the next 2 or 3 years, this isn't about stuff that was in packages, so we'd ask the riders for all that crap back.
Uh-huh.
And we had, oh, my Lord, we had tons of it. And so finally, some of the kids that worked there, I didn't want to just throw it away, so we'd put it in a van, and I'd let them keep the money, and they'd go to the swap meet with it. But we sold all that stuff. You know, we were trying to get as much of it back just so we wouldn't have to pay the sales tax.
Pay the sales tax on it. Wow. Yeah. You know, that might
But no, there's not. You know, I'm amazed at how many different people have come up with stuff that's still in the package. I have just a few things, but it was later toward the end of the JT thing that I have. I don't have any of the stuff left over. Well, maybe a few things. I think I've got one of Ricky's. We made some special stuff for him. I've got some of that that's brand new. But
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But they're okay.
But there are individuals around that are really into that. I met that. Is his name? Oh Lordy, Johnny O'Hanna or what's his name?
Yeah, Johnny O'Hanna. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a neat guy. I met him in Las Vegas, and I don't know. He sounds like he might have some of it.
He's got some of it. Some of it's made up, though. It's not real. He got the logos, you know, put on a cotton jersey or whatever, which was still pretty innovative. But so there is no secret bunker.
No secret bunker.
Interesting. What about when you paintball started picking up? Things started happening. Moto was sliding a little bit. who buys the company? Who approaches you? How does that go? And are you more than happy to wash your hands of it at that point?
Well, I think that anybody in the industry, I think along the way, just about everybody would have thanked God if they could have gotten off the horse somehow. But, you know, my analogy is being on a horse that you can't get off of. You can, you know, you can steer it left or right, and sometimes it slows down and sometimes it speeds up, but you're on it for life. And paintball put us into a position that got us some attention from, you know, publicly held companies, one of them being a company called Brass Eagle. They had something to do with the Daisy Air Rifle people, and Brass Eagle was their paintball division. And we were becoming more and more aggressive, and I got the Walmart account for paintball, and seemed like it was the next day the phone rang and they wanted to talk, and after I'd been through this thing of people coming through and kicking your tires and wanting to buy, and then they wouldn't have any money, or they, you know, it was such a hassle that I asked them for a huge big deposit, and God, lo and behold, there it was, and I knew they were serious about buying, and 2 months it was all over. But it was a big relief. You know, I was 60. Rita was... There's a lot of pressure in that company. My God, you can't believe it. You know, we were privately held, and we had our houses mortgaged. By the time we got to paintball, we were incredibly profitable, but we could remember those times when we weren't.
Right.
And it was a good time, and it was a good opportunity for us to get out with a good return on our investment over the years, so we just took advantage of it.
Right, right. And obviously a good enough a sale where you don't have to work anymore.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you can't really blame you.
No, not really.
And then how did – now, forgive my ignorance, but how did Brass Eagle do with the JT line? Is it still going strong?
Well, I don't know about going – no, I know it's not going strong.
Okay, not going strong anymore in paintball? No.
I hired a kid by the name of Dave DeHaan, and at the time, he was the best paintball player, one of the best paintball players in the world. I was amazed at the number of people that recognized him on the street. Well, Dave eventually became my son-in-law. He married Rhonda, our oldest daughter. And they've kind of picked up where the Brass Eagle people, they don't have the fire in the belly that an independently owned company does.
Yeah.
And the minute you buy a little company from a couple of people that put their lives into it.
Yeah.
You
know, literally their lives.
Fire
yeah.
goes down.
Right.
And then, which was good for my family in the long run, because Dave and Rhonda, their company is called Die Precision. They're the number one paintball in the world today.
Wow. In a way, John Gregory, you've done it again, in a way.
In a way, yeah, you're right. But Brass Eagle sold, and then my God, now I think that the people that licensed Dre and those guys, I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't even know they even had the brand at the time.
Really,
they're that big.
Yeah,
they were just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
I haven't kept up with the paintball part of it, but I know that, but what I hear through other people and through Dave and Rhonda they're not doing, it's not the same anymore.
Yeah. Now the new guys that are starting JT, they would have went to the new owners to license the logo and the name and all the moto stuff, right? Not you.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right.
I had absolutely nothing to do with that whatsoever. I just got a phone call one day, and it was all probably the same surprise to me as it was to you.
Right. Weird that the company gave them, like, the, I don't know, just weird that the paintball company, I guess, from you, took the motocross logos and everything. I guess that's just part of the sale. You know what I mean? Like, when the paintball stuff came in, you know, the moto logos weren't necessarily used on it, but I guess they own it all. So
well, by that time, we were using, even in motocross, we had begun to use the new logo.
Oh, okay.
And I'm pretty sure they'll eventually, they can use that logo, but
yeah.
They chose to go basically full retro on their introduction.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Tortelli gave me a hat, and it's the old gold wreath 70s logo.
Yeah.
You know, talking about your swap meet story of old JT stuff, when I was a kid, my parents took me to San Diego to go riding. I was from Canada, obviously. I went riding, went with Marty Smith. I kind of have a relationship with Marty a little bit. And we went to Tijuana, and we were looking at some motorcycle stores, and I found a pair of pants that had red Bad Bones on the front, and they were personalized Honda down the back of the leg, and then they had some name on the back that I never recognized. And I bet you those are one of those pants you got back from somebody that they sold at a swap meet, which now pisses me off that I never bought those.
could have been. There was some really neat stuff.
Yeah.
Some one-off stuff that went out there that, of course, we lost track of.
My family and I were like, check these out, these personalized JTs. And then, I don't know, the guy maybe wanted too much money for them. Who knows? They could have been Bales pants or something.
They look new?
Yeah, they were new, but they were personalized with the name on the back and, you know, and all that stuff. But
well, by that time, there were some pretty innovative people in Mexico. They were
kind of,
they'd do whatever they wanted to also.
Yeah, and also, yeah, too, later on in my life, I remember a buddy of mine bought like a fake V2000, like a Chinese V2000.
Yeah, that was one that was made in Taiwan. We were successful in stopping that. We had several patents on that product.
Did you? Okay, yeah. So I don't remember. You know, it had no logos on it or anything. It looked like a ripoff, obviously.
Yeah, it was. There was one almost exact. That was a Thor thing. They were the ones that did it.
Oh, really? Oh. Oh, wow. Well, cool, man. Well, thanks. Thanks for doing this. Kept you a little longer than I thought, but. I got a lot of questions for John Gregory, as you can see.
Well, if you think of more, give me a call. I'm just sort of sitting here watching snow.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, thanks for doing this on the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast Show. Truly a legend of the industry, and I'm glad that you've let myself and the listeners in on sort of the stories behind the legend. And with you getting inducted into the Hall of Fame and with JT Gear coming back, I think this works out pretty good, John.
Well, you're welcome, Steve. I was glad to do it.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
You know, I'll tell you, you ought to call. You ought to call if you want to hear some more funny stories, is call Rita.
Oh, yeah. I probably should, yeah. Huh?
Yeah, you really should.
And,
you ought to get her involved. She's got more than I do. She's got a much better memory than I do.
Right. Oh, man, we could really go down the path of JT Racing. I'd love to hear some Bale and RJ and Lachine stories and all that.
Stay in touch. I'll start thinking of things.
Oh, great! Yeah, thank you. And it's too bad about that bunker because I'd like to visit it.
Okay. If I uncover it, I'll holler.
Right on. Well, thank you, John Gregory, for being a guest, and let's stay in touch.
Okay, bud. Bye, bye.
Thanks. Bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point to where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The daughter, Ron Lachine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. And, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course, they did. Everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled the pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got this friend up in the atmosphere.